Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, beautiful. All the laws and legislation in the world will never heal this world like the loving hearts and arms of mothers and fathers.
For amber waves of grace.
You know, if every child could drift to sleep feeling wrapped in the love of their family and God's love, this world would be a far more gentle and better place. President Obama promised to begin to slow the rise of the oceans and to heal the planet. My promise is to help you and your family.
Look here. I'm talking about America.
She's here for your country. America. She's here for your state. She's here for your family. She's your voice against the erosion of your culture. Missouri Grassroots Radio is proud to present your culture vigilante, Miss Lisa Payne Nager. She's here for you.
Good evening and happy Halloween to you all. This is Lisa Payne Nager and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. And this is your culture vigilante hour Halloween show. We are scaring the liberal right out of all the kids in my neighborhood. You're going to hear probably the Halloween chaos going on in the background here. We've got kids running and coming and going and ringing the doorbell and dogs barking and screaming music and all kinds of things going on out there. So just want everybody to know that we're here to get the Halloween celebration started and to bring on the election in less than 7 days. So we're pretty excited about all of that. We've got a pretty full lineup. There's been a lot of stuff going on. You know, it's that last crunch down to election time, and the ads are flying, and people are screaming, you know, and accusations are coming and from left and right, and there's just something going on everywhere. Last week, we had some great information about the Claire McCaskill, Joe Shepard issue coming out of St. Louis Tea Party blogger Darren Morley from Reboot Congress. He had some great information. He does some great investigative citizen journalism at Reboot Congress. And he exposed millions and millions of dollars going into the McCaskill private coffers out of taxpayers' funds through the way they were structuring their private companies. And we have some more information about that tonight from Ken Bohm. And we have Peter Kinder with us tonight, and we're going to have Cynthia Davis with us tonight to talk about their race for lieutenant governor. And we'll have Ray Cuneo with us again to talk to us a little bit more about Agenda 21 and give us some information about the Wildlands Project and how that's going to affect you folks. And we'll have Gary Wigert on with us because he's going to tell us why it's really important to vote no on Prop A. But before we get to that, we just want to talk for a couple of minutes. We're all going to the polls on Tuesday. Everybody's going to get their opportunity to go back and take their government back by going and voting, and that's the best way that you can do this. The best way you can start the revolution is at the polls by going and exercising your vote. And we've all gotten behind the candidates in the last couple of weeks, or probably over the whole election season for the last year. Many of us have worked for candidates, and we're trying to spread the message and spread the word. I want to caution you, we have this rant on culture vigilante before. Being involved and engaged in your election process is the best thing that you can do for taking back your country and taking back your government. But in a few days, we're going to elect some people to office, and we have to remember, with all the blood, sweat, and tears that we put into putting these people in office, we have to remember not to be emotionally involved with our candidates and our elected, because we're putting them there to work for us. And when you become emotionally involved with your elected, it's very hard to hold their feet to the fire. And it's never been more important than it is now to be able to hold your elected's feet to the fire. There's so much work to be done. There's so much damage that needs to be corrected. And when they get elected, they sing a different tune. That fire in the belly seems to go out, and they can't seem to get control of things as fast as they told you they could get control of them when they were campaigning, or it may not be the right thing for them to do at this time. Let's wait another election cycle. I mean, the excuses start to fly. And you, as informed and engaged citizens who help to elect candidates, cannot put up with that attitude any longer. It's time to start holding people's feet to the fire. And if you are emotionally engaged with these candidates, you cannot do that. So let them know you're happy to work for them. You're happy to put them in office. But your contributions of your time and your money and your blood, sweat, and tears to put them there, you expect something for that contribution, just as all those big money donors expect something for their contributions when they donate to these candidates. You, the people, expect something for your contributions. So don't back down. Stick to the course. Stay firm. And just let these folks know that they work for you. It's not the other way around. We have a lot of other things going on. I wanted to let you know, folks, earlier today I posted a voter guide, Missouri Grassroots Coalition. You've probably seen voter guides everywhere. Every organization's got their own voter guide, and they vary a little bit here or there for whatever reason. Well, we have our own, too, and it's up at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. You can go there and you can read how we feel about the issues there, the Missouri Grassroots Coalition. And we've also listed a listing of other folks' voter guides as well, so that you can make your comparisons and become informed as you go to the polling place on Tuesday. And there's also a link in there to vet your judges as well. I personally, I don't think any of those vehicles that are in place to vet the judges are really rigorous enough for me, so I vote no on retaining all the judges. And I happen to live in St. Charles County, where we vote in our circuit judges as well, and most of them run unopposed, and I don't cast a vote for unopposed judges. I feel that's when judges run unopposed, and they almost always do in St. Charles County, it just screams of cronyism to me. So while they're going to be elected anyway, if nobody voted for them and they only voted for themselves, they would be elected. I think that it sends a strong message to not cast a vote for those folks and let that voting number come in very low, and send a message to let them know that you're not happy with this unopposed elected judge situation. You want to see a little bit more challenge and a little bit more competition in that seat, so that and a little bit more transparency and information about how they've run their careers and how they campaign, so that we can make some better and informed decisions. Also, again, we're going to talk. This is, aren't you so glad that it's almost over, because we've been beating this horse to death. But in St. Charles County, we have 6 charter amendments on the ballot in the county. And every single one of those charter amendments takes power away from the people and puts it in the hands of the county executive, I think, except for one, which is already addressed in the county charter. So everyone, I can't say it strongly enough, everybody should vote no on all the St. Charles County charters. And I think I've listed that also in the voter guide at Missouri Grassroots Coalition. You can go there and read why. And I've also put the same voter guide up at culturevigilante.wordpress.com, so you can go there and read about that as well. Also want to let you know, if you're in the St. Charles County area and you've been following this Save Our Sheriff initiative that we've got going here, again, another initiative to take the voting rights away from the people, and put the appointing of our of a police chief of our county into the hands of the county executive. If that's not your cup of tea, and we're urging people to vote no on that initiative so that you can maintain the voting privileges for voting your sheriff into office, we're having a sign wave on Wentzville Parkway in front of the Schnooks on Saturday at 12:30. Come and join us. We'll have literature to pass out. We'll have signs. Come out there and say hi. We'll be there from 12:30 to 2. And get to know, if you don't understand after all this time about what's going on with that initiative, come on out and we'll explain it to you. Pick up a yard sign. Take it home and put it in your yard. Bring one for your neighbor. We'll be happy to see you there. Okay, like I said, we have got a really, really full show for you tonight. So we're going to go ahead and get started. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with Gary Wigert, and he's going to give us the lowdown on Prop A.
This is the Grassroots Minute. We hear all the horror stories from the environmentalists who put forth the idea that oil fracking is destroying the earth. Of course, until they test the water before any fracking is performed, they are mostly political in nature to fit their agenda. For instance, the movie Grassland sounded terrible until it was discovered that the water there had been ignitable for decades in a well-known natural occurrence. Did anyone notice the fact was left out of the movie? If there are dangers or downsides, we need that confirmed and remedied, but must not let this government limit our ability to produce our own energy. We could become a third world country overnight if the Saudis decide to cut off our oil. Do we want to chance that? Fracking has been going on for decades. It was only when it appeared that natural gas was going to be the energy of the future instead of solar and wind that the big stink came about. I believe the extreme environmentalists and the folks who want to implement Agenda 21 are behind this scare. Another little-known fact is that the poster child of green energy, Germany, has given up on solar and wind after spending millions and millions on subsidies. German President Merkel is a realist and wants to save the economy of her country. Therefore, Germany is in the process of building over 30 coal-fired plants in her country, and we are shutting down our coal plants. What does that say to you? We need the energy that it produces to stay energy independent. The environmental nightmares of the green energies are never discussed. Have you ever asked yourself why? I'm Terry Varner for the Grassroots Minute.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you are listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour, and we are hot into the issues tonight. We've got a lot of stuff going on. This is our last chance before the election to hammer it out there, to let you know where we stand on the issues, and hopefully you'll go to the polls and support these things. Tonight we have with us Gary Wigert. Gary is a St. Louis City police officer. He's been a police officer in the city for a really long time. I don't know exactly how long, but a very long time. And he has been with the force, you know, for many years. He's seen the ins and outs and the politics that go on down there. He knows what the neighborhoods are like. He knows what it takes to take care of business in the city. And he has been almost a lone voice out there opposing this Proposition A. This Proposition A situation, which is going to try to restore local control of the St. Louis City Police Department back to the city. Right now it's under state control. And Gary is going to tell us why that's a bad idea. This is a situation that's been very well funded by big money donors and big Democratic machines. And while we all believe that local control in philosophy is a good thing, there are a lot of reasons why it's not the right thing for St. Louis City, and it's not going to solve the problems that they have in the city. So thank you for being with us tonight, Gary. We appreciate your input.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, Lisa.
So, you know, you've been on the show before. You've been all over the place talking about this Proposition A. There are a lot of patriots out there, and I'm one of them. You know, when I hear the right kind of talk, you know, we all love local control. We all, you know, the way the Constitution is written, things should be a certain way and government should be structured a certain way. And we all buy that line, hook, line, and sinker. And I think a lot of this Proposition A has been co-opted under that premise, that there are a lot of reasons why people would want local control. But why, Gary, under this circumstance, is local control not the right thing?
Well, you know, I believe also in government closest to the people is the best government. And in this situation, what we have right now are four citizens who are chosen by the governor, and they serve on the board of police commissioners. They hire, they fire, they promote, they set the rules. And we like that idea that you have four citizens versus a mayoral bureaucracy, which is what it will revert to. We will then go, instead of the chief reporting to four citizens and the mayor, what he will report to is a public safety director who then reports to the mayor, who then will report to the Board of Aldermen, the 28th Board of Aldermen. So what we're doing is we're creating another level of bureaucracy to administer our police department. And, you know, our police department, we have enough politics in it as it is now. And we're afraid that if in fact, city control, which is what I call political control, if that's instituted, then people will actually be farther away from the police department, because now they're going to have to go through the whole bureaucracy to get something done. Where here you have four people who live within the community that you're able to contact and have some influence with instead of political influence. And that's what we're afraid of. We like that firewall between the police department and city government.
And that's what most of us have. Most of us that have sheriff's departments, I mean, that's government closest to the people. You have your law enforcement between the people and between the government. While that's not the way it is in the cities and the municipalities of Missouri, the large municipalities of Missouri, this restoring this local control is not going to help create that environment. Right. And I've been reading a lot of very good short articles at 24state.com that outline a lot of situations that are going to be brought into this local control issue in the city if it passes.
Now, you have to look at who everybody right now is trying to the sharks are swimming around the police department and they all want their piece and they all want their little piece of the pie. And so you have these groups, and that's the article we just wrote about. I assume you're referring to today, and that was called Viva La Local Control.
Right.
And that is because La Raza and a group called Kansas City Civic Latino Collective, they both support local control. If you look up Safer Missouri, you'll see their name on there. Both of them say they're for Latino issues, but really what they're for is for illegal aliens, and they are for sanctuary cities. And what a lot of people don't know what sanctuary cities are set up in a lot of the major cities. And basically what it does is it encourages illegals to come to their city. Because when you bring in illegals, you bring in money, basically, because you have illegals that have children who receive the welfare benefits. They receive the food stamp. It actually is an industry in and of itself. So basically inviting these folks in here. And what happens is you have some of these big cities, you have these criminals who come in, these drug dealers. You can't ask them if they're illegal or not. They don't have to give you any identity if you're a sanctuary city.
But we don't have sanctuary cities in Missouri, is that right? So how does that affect us?
What happened was Matt Blunt, when he was governor, under him, the legislature, and that's what's funny, all these legislators who voted against sanctuary cities, some of them now are supporting local control, but it was a good idea to be against sanctuary cities, and they passed that in Missouri, that we can't have sanctuary cities. The problem is if the city doesn't enforce the law, then doesn't have their police enforce the law, then it really doesn't mean anything. And I tell people as an example, years ago, the police were ordered to take a felon into custody any way necessary. So state law said you can shoot fleeing felons. But on our police department, when I came on the police department, they said, well, you're not going to go to jail for it if you shoot a fleeing felon, but you will be fired. So, I mean, the city can come in, and it doesn't make any difference if it's state law that says it's improper. If they fire you for enforcing it, well, then it puts you in a bad situation.
Okay, which leads me to my next question, because if this passes, if Prop 8 passes, there's going to be a whole different criteria for how they evaluate issues with police officers, right? There will be no transparency left.
Right. People don't realize it's you know, the police have a lot of power and a lot of discretion on how they enforce these laws. And we like that being basically the state saying, hey, you will do this, you will do that. And we like that. And as you know right now, if you remember, I'm trying to think of Senator Will Krause, he tried to sponsor that bill where you could even have the police just gather the numbers. Like if you make a car stop, you can inquire if somebody's an illegal alien. And there was a lot of outrage from folks who went and testified against that bill. And I think I was the only one from the St. Louis Tea Party who actually testified in his behalf. So you have people, they understand, a lot of folks understand out here that police officers are the first, what do you call it, the front line when it comes to enforcing these laws.
Mm-hmm.
And the city tells them, hey, you are not going to enforce this law or we will fire you, then there's not much you can do about it.
And the discipline of police officers then will not be public discipline anymore the way it is now.
Right, and I'll explain that to your listeners too. As it stands right now in front of the Board of Police Commissioners, if someone wants to, if I am charged with malfeasance or a crime or any type of incident that can result in a 15-day suspension, that hearing is open to the public. The media can attend, anyone in the public can attend, and they can actually listen to the facts and they can judge guilt and innocence while they're sitting there. It's open. And if in fact we vote yes on Prop A it will no longer be open to the public, but will go to the Civil Service Commission, which is under the city charter, and it will be closed. It will be closed to the public. And I'll be honest with you, I do not like that, because I'm afraid that Mayor Slate can basically hold a hearing and fire me, and I don't have the protection of the media or the public being able to judge me also. They can take a look and see what's being done properly and what isn't being done properly, if, in fact, we have some transparency.
So
and
all
it's
of
open
this-
to the public.
Yeah, so all of this argument about putting it back in the hands of the people, they're really not going to know, because what's happening is if you put this back in the hands of the St. Louis City administrators, they're going to do business behind closed doors, and the public isn't going to know what's going on behind closed doors.
I think that's a valid statement. Now, also, right now, as I don't know if you followed, but we have the chief has announced that he's retiring. He's going to leave and take a job somewhere else, and we're going to be choosing a chief. Now, if you are somebody like a Rex Singfeld and you just spent $1 million to control over to the police department or to the city, don't you think the person who spent that $1 million is going to be the one who determines who's going to be the next chief?
Yeah. Well, Rex spends a lot of money all over the state, and he gets a lot of what he wants. So why should the city be any different?
Right. When you spend that $1 million, you're now calling the shots. And I don't think the people here in St. Louis are going to be calling the shots on this. Could be the person who spent all the money.
Okay.
Now, I know it's touted out here that, you know, local control is a good thing, but I think local control is not a good thing on every incident. And if you look at Governor Perry down in Texas, he was so outraged at the sanctuary cities that he tried to pass a law in Texas to try and outlaw them, because they just recently had a police officer, very popular police officer. He was killed by an illegal alien. He had been caught 3 times, convicted of various crimes, sent to Mexico, and then he comes right back. And so this last time he just killed a policeman in Houston, Texas. So that city out there is doing protests. They're doing marches. They're very upset. And apparently down in Houston, this is the African-American community community that's very upset, because this was an African-American officer who was very popular there. And unfortunately, this is what you get with these sanctuary cities.
So, yeah. So even though Missouri is not a sanctuary city state, you know, it all depends on if they truly enforce it. And sometimes, and as we know, things don't always – we don't enforce laws here in the state all the time.
Right. That's
so
correct.
There's no guarantee.
Now, I also want to point out some of the other groups that are supporting local control. And, you know, it's basically all left-wing groups. Now, you've got a couple groups. You've got two groups in there. You've got, I think, the Cadminton Tea Party. I really don't know who they are. And some family network group, their name's on that list. But if you look on the whole list of Safer Missouri, you will see it's all pretty much left-wing groups.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the St. Louis Labor Council. You have the AFL-CIO. You have the Police Officers Association, which is now wavering on their endorsement. But the only reason the union supported this was because the Police Officers Association signed a contract with the Board of Police Commissioners, and in that contract, they were granted fair share. Now, I was head of the union there for 6 years. I understand how the union operates. I understand fair share. But what they did with fair share is if you are not a member of the union, and in this case, it's the police department, usually it's your employee, but they forcibly, and this is forcibly, take your money and give it to the union. And I think that is so wrong to be able to do that, to forcibly take a person's money. And what it's being done is to try and kill the other two labor organizations. You have an African-American organization. You also have a supervisor's organization. Now, the unions and the police union, they agreed to this because they wanted to wipe out these two other groups and knock out competition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was head of the union, I believed in competition. I think competition makes you a better leader, because you now have to meet the wishes of your membership. But once you have something like fair share, you can just do whatever you want to your membership, and they have to take it. And this is another part of the deals that they're doing out here, just to carve up our police department, because everybody's getting a piece of the pie.
Yeah, and already the corruption is oozing its way into the cracks.
I mean, and you can see this already before. I mean, look at all the politics involved in just trying over our police department. Think of the politics that's going to be involved if, in fact, they do take it over. Yeah. It's a mess. Now,
so,
you have... Go ahead.
Go ahead, Rhett. Go ahead.
I said you got other groups, too, that support this. You have Civic Progress. And the reason Civic Progress supports this is they believe in a city-county merge. And so I believe that they've put their weight behind this. And if you notice, just last week in the paper, there was a big, I don't know if you read the Post-Dispatch, but there was a big article about a city-county merger. And the county, some of these people want to merge the city and the county. And I think basically what that's doing is it wants the county to incur some of the debt that the city has, because we always have problems down here.
Yeah, there's been a push for a long time. And Rex Sinkfield is in favor of a city-county merger, is he not?
Yes, that's what I understand. That's a lot of this push.
Right. Okay, folks. I mean, you know, again, philosophy-wise, of course, we want local control. This isn't local control. This is not giving you what you think you're voting for. This is a piece of Yankee Doodle legislation. It's deceptive. It's going to come back to bite you in the backside sooner than you realize. Vote no on Prop A.
Hey Lisa, yeah. One thing, too, about, like, you're having this problem out there in St. Charles. Now, everybody thinks that these charter form of government is a great thing, and I think that's what they're pushing, whether it's here in St. Louis or St. Charles. They want to be able to, the mayor who's ever in charge, he wants to appoint, he wants total control of everything. They want to actually take power from the people and then give it to the people who run the cities, basically.
Right, same
thing. And I think actually the citizens lose their power when this type of stuff happens.
Yep. The parallels are very clear. So, and I think that there are a lot of people who are going to go out to the polls on Tuesday and vote for this because they think it's going to solve a problem and give some of that power back to the people. But that's not the way it is. It's Yankee Doodle legislation. It's being sold as one thing, and it's something completely different. It's not going to give people power. It's really going to allow for the powers that are already in place to manipulate the system and take control away from the people.
If you look at the terminology that's in the wording, I believe it says it might save $3.5 million. Now, when you hear a word like might, that
mm-hmm.
means absolutely nothing. But it also says that since 2006, I think they've spent $6 million defending police officers through the Attorney General's office, which is correct. And that should probably go back to the city, but it doesn't need a total takeover of the police department for the city to pay for their own legal fees.
Yeah, it's not going to stop the city from having to defend itself on issues.
No.
So that's not going to go away, whether or not you have local control or not.
What happened there was Matt Blunt stepped up because, you know, St. Louis is a very litigious area, and city juries were giving out outlandish money awards on these lawsuits against the police department. So the state of Missouri under Matt Blunt stepped up and says, hey, we're gonna start representing these guys because the state of Missouri can cap some of these awards, which is great for us. It's actually kept costs down for the city of St. Louis. And I'm tired of all this stuff now. It's like disparaging Matt Blunt over all these things, whether it's a sanctuary city or stepping in and helping the police officers. You also had Matt Blunt stepped up, and he appointed commissioners that allowed police officers to live in freedom, live where they want to live. Now, under the city charter, it says the police officers will live within the city limits of St. Louis. Well, you know what? That's a basic freedom that is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there is any Tea Party person I know who believes that the police should be forced to live in the city, within the city limits. But yet I see some Tea Party folks out here saying, well, you know, if that's what the employer wants, then that's what the employer should get. And I have to beg to differ on that. I mean, you never give up your constitutional rights just because somebody employs you.
That's true.
And
okay.
I think we have to get rid of that frame of thinking.
All right, Gary Wigert, I thank you so much for all of the work. I mean, Gary has done this. He's been self-funded. He's not got the funding of anybody backing him. It's Tea Party grassroots effort. He's done a great job at getting the word out to the folks. Please listen to what he's had to say. Go to 24state.net, folks, and read what he's written there about the details of what Prop A is going to do if you pass this if you pass this amendment. Thank you, Gary, for being with us. Good job and all the hard work that you've done to get the information out to the folks, and best of luck to you on Tuesday.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Hey, I'll put out the website real quick, too. It's www.propa.webs, W-E-B-S.com. And thank you so much, Lisa. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Gary. Have a good evening. Happy Halloween.
You too. Good night.
Good night. Okay, we're going to take a real quick break, and we're going to come back and listen to Ken Bohm, and he's going to tell us about Claire and her husband and their business dealings.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
Abroad are inextricably linked. Our friends and allies must again be able to trust us. From Israel to Colombia, from Poland to the Philippines, our allies and friends have to know that we will be reliable and consistent and determined. And our foes can have no reason to doubt our resolve, because peace really does come through strength.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
We're back. This is Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you are listening to the Culture Vigilante Hour on Halloween night. And their kids are screaming and howling, and you know, we're scaring the liberalism right out of them right here in my neighborhood. So you got to get them early and indoctrinate them young so that you can turn them into nice conservative kids. So you got to do it one way or another. We're trying to do it on Halloween night. And Dave has joined us. I'm assuming that he's been out trick-or-treating with the kids. Nice to be with you, Dave. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lisa. It's always great to be here with you, even on Halloween.
Even on Halloween. So are you celebrating Halloween down there in Springfield?
We have already celebrated it. Yes, we have a tradition at our house, and you know, my wife has a lot of homemade soup she makes. So Halloween is always the very first soup night of the year traditionally, and all the kids come by and have some soup and bread, and we put some jalapeno poppers on the grill, and we had some roll up belly buttons. That's right.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah, I made a gallon and a half of bean and bacon soup. And my wife made some potato soup. Yeah. So yeah, we had fun. They've all been and gone. They got to get the kids home and in bed. You know, it's a school night.
There you go. Well, very good. We're still scaring the kids out here in Lake St. Louis, so we'll be hearing about that for sure for a long time to come. We like to kind of play the scary music, and we've got the pumpkins carved, and my son is home, so he's out there in his ghoul costume scaring the little ones to death. So anyway, back to business. Okay, we got a lot of stuff going on here tonight. Last week, we talked to Darren Morley from Reboot Congress, and he gave us some great information about some things that he found about Claire McCaskill's husband, Joe Shepherd, and how he's structuring his business there. And there's been a lot of stuff going on, a lot of stuff coming out that the mainstream media is not picking up about what Claire's business affairs are. The Shepherd McCaskills have made millions upon millions upon millions of dollars at taxpayer expense, making deals in the Senate dining room, selling tax credits to open businesses for low-income housing. And there's just one thing after another. Anyway, Darren had some great information on Reboot Congress last week. If you have an opportunity, go to rebootcongress.net. He's updated some of that information throughout the week. And we've also I had an opportunity to talk earlier today with Ken Bohm. Ken is with the National Legal and Policy Center in New York, and if Darren didn't do enough investigative journalism, Ken Bohm is a forensic genius. I mean, he has delved into information about Claire McCaskill's finances like nobody else has. And there's only been one story in the AP that barely touched on it. And you can read about that at nlpc.org. But we have an interview now with Ken Boehm, and he goes into detail about just exactly what Claire and her husband have been up to. Let's listen to that right now.
This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. If you'll recall, last week we had Darren Morley on from Reboot Congress, and he introduced us to a lot of research that he did on the Claire McCaskill, Joe Shepherd issue, where it seems that the McCaskills have profited greatly by some of the stimulus funds and some of the policies that Claire McCaskill has voted through since she's been senator, $40 million in federal subsidies for low-income housing, and there seems to be more. Today we have with us Ken Boehm from the National Legal and Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Mr. Boehm has done just an amazing amount of research. From what I spoke to him a little bit yesterday, and from what we found out is that there are a lot of underlying corporations and a lot of underlying pathways to finding more of this kind of behavior from the McCaskill Shepherds, and he's here with us today to kind of walk us through that information. Thanks for being with us today, Ken.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
So you published an article. We broke this last week on Culture Vigilante last week on Wednesday, and you published an article on Thursday with much more detail and much more information on just how Joe Shepherd structures his companies to kind of I don't want to say hide, but he almost hides these corporations in multi levels of government. And the money that's going through these multiple corporations that he and McCaskill own together is just, it's phenomenal. It's all funded with taxpayer money, yes?
Yes, and the big picture for people who have not been following this sector closely is that Claire McCaskill is one of the wealthiest U.S. senators. Now, there's many wealthy U.S. senators. You've got Senator Curry of Massachusetts, people like that. But what makes her wealthy in a different way is her wealth is based on her husband's real estate financing empire, and that is largely based on low-income housing, and the tax credits are available for that. And for folks to say, how can you become wealthy on low-income housing? And the answer is, there's pour billions of dollars a year into various programs to benefit it. And in the past, people who had a political pull have been able to amass quite a bit of money. And that's really the story behind her fortune, which is worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars, possibly quite a bit more. And I can give you the quick background on it. The quick background is this. People have known for years in Missouri that she has her husband's thing has been based on her husband's fortune has been based on taxpayer money. But some new things have come out just in the last month. And one of the new things that came out was that the AP did a story early October. And AP did the story, said something like $40 million in benefits went to these various entities that her husband's company benefited from, her husband's various companies benefited from. And that's a big number, $40 million. Now, her response to that, or her campaign's response, because she was not made available to AP, but her husband's response to that, her campaign's response was, well, that's not what we made. You know, we made a small amount, and these were partnerships and so forth. We found an additional $20 million that went to entities, and all of the $20 million, it's actually over $20 million, came from the stimulus bill. Claire McCaskill supported the stimulus bill. Claire McCaskill had a role in shaping the stimulus bill. She argued for it on the floor of the Senate. She proposed amendments. She, in effect, campaigned for it. And every cent that came out that benefited her family, presumably she knew about in advance. It's hard to imagine somebody with her background as a state auditor
right.
didn't know that there was going to be $20 million plus benefiting her companies, her husband's companies. And, of course, she's married, and they're jointly owned as a couple, and so this is money that directly benefits her. And she kept that a secret, and it's been essentially a secret since the stimulus bill passed in early 2009, and now in October, by spending hours and hours going through thousands of public records, we were able to show exactly how that money flowed. And it's scary because it does point to a certain degree of cronyism. I'll give you an example. When the federal government poured this money, it's something like $30 million to Missouri for low-income housing, they put it into something or to be administered by something called the Missouri Housing Development Commission. It's a state-based entity that administers a lot of HUD funds and other funds. The executive director of the Missouri Housing Development Commission was during this time when it was getting all this money, was a former business partner of Joseph Shepard. That's Senator McCaskill's husband's name. And what do you know, a good chunk of the money, more than $20 million of 30-something million, went to entities that were directly financially tied to Joe Shepard. And so if we're following the money, which is the Watergate dictum, 30-something million comes from Washington, stimulus bill. It goes to an entity run by Joe Shepard's former business partner. And then, even though it was very competitive, or that's what we were told in numerous stories around the country, lots of low-income housing folks wanted this money. What do you know? Six of the groups that get it are tied to Joe Shepard's companies. Now, how are they tied to him? Shepard has a company called Missouri Tax Credit Fund, LP, Limited Partnership. They get involved in financing. What they did, and this is where it becomes very secretive, they worked through a third-party group, which was financing these six entities that were going to benefit from the money. This in-between group was run by people who were associated for many, many years with Joe Shepard as employees. Then he issues them financing. And we know this because we looked up the financing records or something called Uniform Commercial Code. It's where people file financing statements, much the way an individual person who buys a home and gets it mortgaged files a mortgage. And when we sat down and pieced together the trail led right to this Missouri Tax Credit Fund owned by Shepard, and of course his wife, Senator McCaskill. Now, we don't know exactly how much they got, but I can tell you that this Missouri Tax Credit Fund is very, very lucrative for Senator McCaskill and her husband. And we know this because every senator has to file an annual financial disclosure report under the Ethics in Government Act, and anybody can get this on the internet. And when we looked at Claire McCaskill's financial disclosure reports, which just go on for page and page after page because of the fortune.
So many companies. Yeah.
And when we look at this, we see that this Missouri Tax Credit Fund was only worth $500,000 to $1 million in 2008. But 2009, once the stimulus passed, it's worth in the highest category, which is simply called over $1 million. And in 2010, it was worth over $1 million. 2011, over $1 million. Even more important than what it was worth is how much income came to Senator McCaskill and her husband, and what she checked there was the same category, over a million in 2009, 2010, and 2011. Now,
and that could be, I mean, that could be 5 million. I mean, it could be a million and $1. It could be 5 million.
Right.
It could be $10 million. We don't know because they don't release
because
that.
She will not disclose her income tax returns. And the reason I think she won't, and some politicians do and some don't, the reason she should, as distinguished from others, is this. They get their money from the federal, all these federal and state programs. And we know from her airplane fiasco last year, where her husband's companies or networks of companies owned the airplane, she was billing the taxpayer, but oops, some of the money went for flights that were political, which meant that taxpayers were improperly and illegally funding political flights for Senator McCaskill. So she got burned on that, and then it turned out, because of the secretiveness, we didn't know this at the time the story first broke, that this plane should have been paying taxes, local taxes, because it's, you know, one valuable asset. And that was hundreds of thousands of dollars. So her secretiveness and her husband's interests and financial interests have before been controversial and illegal, and now we're getting into even bigger chunks of money. And by way of comparison, every U.S. senator gets $174,000 a year, which is a decent salary, and they get other benefits attached to that, and so forth. But compare her $174,000 a year salary as a U.S. senator with the more than $1 million she and her husband make just from this one company, and this company is in the business of financing low-income housing, and it's pretty easy to finance low-income housing even during a credit freeze and financial downturn when the federal government's supplying all the money.
Well, and we also know that Joe Shepard has been using the position of his wife, I mean, to sell some of the tax credits that he's obtained. There's an audio floating around out there where he's been selling, making deals in the Senate dining room with members. You know, he's got the privilege of eating in the Senate dining room because his wife is a U.S. senator, and he's making deals there to sell some of his tax credits. And in effect, correct me if I'm wrong here, what we have here is we have a prominent U.S. senator's husband who is benefiting, building a business off the benefit of tax credits, which his wife supported, and tax money, taxpayer money, and then he's also benefiting from those people who are living in this low-income housing, which he's this business that he's built, which are probably being paid by taxpayer funds.
You've got that, and then you've got the fact that HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, funneled tens of millions through that Missouri Housing Development Corporation headed by his former business partner. They were supposed to compete them competitively. Hopefully they did. But it seems like at least something of a conflict of interest when his companies benefit from six of the awards worth more than $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that former business partner that headed up that state commission unexpectedly and abruptly resigned once most of this money had been awarded. So there's questions there. And then there's some things, and Lisa, that we discussed yesterday a little bit that weren't in our article, but I can mention them because they're public record, but they're buried away. And nobody else has dug this out publicly, at least certainly not the mainstream media. But the Inspector General of HUD. Inspector generals are the folks who are there to protect the taxpayer against waste, fraud, and abuse. Audited the Missouri Housing Development Commission's stewardship, their administration of these stimulus funds in low-income housing. And what did they find? They found that more than $3 million was spent either improperly or without proper receipts and information. They found a host of irregularities, and while inspectors general do not list the individual programs, the fact that Shepard and his wife, for that matter, financed six of the groups that got more than $20 million out of 30-something million, you have to believe that some of these abuses uncovered by the inspector general were in these programs run by these programs that benefited Mr. Shepard. And that's something we're further looking into. Just have to say a few words about TradeCrypt. We're very, very careful here.
Right.
We have a former inspector general on our board of directors. I'm a former prosecutor. We have people who we work with on a regular basis who have all sorts of skills in going through voluminous filings. This took quite a bit of time. And when we saw the pattern of the money, stimulus money, to the state program run by his business partner, what do you know, the groups that are financially tied to him are getting massive amounts of that money, and then the inspector general does an audit and finds out that over 10% of the money was being spent in a careless, if not improper or illegal way. That paints a picture.
Absolutely. At the very least,
the public's entitled to know what happened with that.
Yeah, at the very least, an investigation is in order.
Yes, and there's lots more. We also found out that another one of Mr. Shepard's companies, he's got quite a few companies, LLCs, limited partnership. In fact, he's got hundreds, and that's just from his wife's financial disclosure report. Another one of his companies benefited because they had financial dealings with five of the six entities that benefited from the stimulus money. So he was getting money in several different ways, benefiting from the stimulus. Now, you'd think that maybe the senator, because she's been outspoken in favor of whistleblowers and transparency and accountability, you think that what she might do would be publicly say, well, my husband's doing this, but I'm going to lay it all out for the taxpayers and let them decide, just to show we have nothing to hide. Well, nothing of the sort.
Right.
As you recall, when the AP came out with their story, her campaign would not make her available to the AP reporter. And that was AP, which is mainstream media, goes without saying that she never put this out for anybody to see until we were able to piece it all together. And I doubt she will. I doubt she will. This is the only time she really lays things out on the table is when, in effect, it's already been exposed. I mean, we saw that with the airplane scandal,
sure.
Air Claire, as they call it. And I suspect that this is going to go on because now that we found out that she has benefited, she and her husband's company have benefited to such a great degree, I think she has to explain what's what. One of the things we're looking at is a complaint to the Inspector General of HUD. He found all these irregularities. There's no sign at all that he knew that the companies benefiting from this did their financing through a series of entities benefiting Senator McCaskill's husband's company. We were very careful in looking through that, and so what we're preparing is a complaint to the Inspector General of HUD saying, you notice this pattern of irregularities. Well, here's six of the entities that got over $20 million of the 30-something million. Could you look to see, number one, how they happen to successfully compete for this money, considering the person who made the awards was a former business partner of the senator's husband? And number two, was there a pattern of these abuses where all kinds of expenditures, money's being spent, these are stimulus funds, meaning your funds and my funds, all federal taxpayers' funds, were being spent improperly. Either it was for a purpose that was not allowed, or they made the expenditure, but they didn't have any paperwork to back it up. To anybody who's out there who's listening, who's a forensic accountant, who deals in the world of accounting, when you start getting millions of dollars, approximately 10% of the money being spent in a way that is either not allowed or cannot be properly documented, that's a scandal. That's a scandal because normal businesses don't come anywhere near that kind of large figure. And the fact that it's taxpayer money and the fact that the senator helped direct that money in terms of voting for it, speaking for it, and even shaping the program just makes it a bigger scandal.
And you're not going to hear about this. There's been one AP article on it that I have been able to find. And you told me that Breitbart picked up your article today and a few other bloggers have picked it up. We've highlighted it on Missouri Grassroots Coalition, and hopefully this will gain some legs, but I really doubt that before the election that the mainstream media is going to pick it up. But we are going to continue to follow this story, Ken Boehm, and we hope that you'll keep us posted on developments as they arise, because this is there are scandals coming out of the Obama administration left and right, and this is another one of them. And here we have this heated senatorial race between Claire McCaskill and Todd Akin, and we can't get this story out into the media. So.
Yeah, the public's entitled to know this. This is the public money, and it's not like we're talking about $50 or $100,000 or even $1 million. We're talking about more than $20 million. And we're talking about it being done in a secretive way because the senator never revealed this. And it's a scandal in the making, and it's quite a big scandal. There have been a lot of scandals associated with the stimulus money. It's been sent overseas. It's been misspent. It's been given to the so-called green energy companies that were run by bundlers for the Obama campaign. The stimulus thing, which was a spectacular flop, as we all know, this was the thing that was supposed to bring down unemployment, and unemployment went higher. This smacks of cronyism. It smacks of certainly taxpayer, abuse of taxpayer funds. And the fact that the senator is not interested whatsoever in explaining to the public how much money she and her husband made from these six entities speaks for itself.
Yeah, what a gross abuse of authority. Well, thank you, Ken Boehm of the National Legal and Policy Center. If you want to read more about this story or other issues that they're working on, go to nlpc.org, and we will be in touch with you. We do want to follow up on this story because I know that you're working on other issues related to this, and we want some follow-ups on that. So thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Ken.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Amazing that this kind of thing can go on, and people are going to vote for her, you know, just quite amazing. And it just unfolds and it gets thicker and deeper as the days go by. So, you know, folks, the only way to get rid of this kind of corruption is to vote it out of office. You have your chance on Tuesday. Make sure you go to the polls. Make sure you vote for the right person. Right now it's not looking like it's Claire. So we're moving on because we're running a little long. We have Lieutenant Governor candidates with us tonight, and on the line we have with us Peter Kinder. He's dropped in on us from the campaign trail. He's going to give us an update on the campaign and answer a few questions before he moves on to Tuesday. Thanks for being with us, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you for having me back on, Lisa, and I can tell you that no matter what the mainstream media says, that your previous guest is right on his analysis of that issue with Senator McCaskill, that scandal that the mainstream media is not covering. And but the people in Missouri are onto it, thanks to the efforts of folks like you in putting the facts out there. And here's what I can tell you. Internal Republican tracking polls, not for the Akin campaign, have him up last night 3 points.
Oh, that's great news.
They have him leading Senator McCaskill. Todd Akin can still win this race. And conservatives and constitutionalists must mobilized for him and support him in the home stretch here the last 6 days.
It's all about getting folks to the polls, and you know, your freedom has absolutely never been more in the balance here, folks. So make sure you get to the polls on Tuesday. This kind of corruption goes on because we have allowed it to go on. And if you want to stop it, you have to go to the polls and you have to vote on Tuesday. And Speaking of voting on Tuesday, you're up for election on Tuesday again. You're running a hot race. How are things going on the campaign trail?
Well, they're going great, Lisa. But speaking of corruption, there's corruption in campaigns, too, as well as in actual holding of public office. My opponent, Susan Monty, who the voters in Missouri fired 2 years ago when she was running for re-election as auditor, they fired her because she would not audit the Obama stimulus money. Why would she? You know, it's part of her job as state auditor to be the watchdog and the bird dog by auditing.
Very cozy.
And she refused to audit the scandalous gusher of Obama stimulus money that came into our state. And it might be because she was the first first statewide office holder in Missouri to endorse Senator Barack Obama 5 years ago. To go to Iowa, while she was being paid by the taxpayers of Missouri, to go to Iowa and campaign for Senator Obama, and to give him the maximum donation and co-chair his campaign in Missouri. So my opponent, Susan Monty, is fully signed on to the radical transformational agenda of the Obama, Pelosi, Reid, McCaskill crowd, and she is nonetheless claiming to be a fiscal conservative. She has no fiscal conservative credentials. She supports Obamacare. She supports abortion on demand, including taxpayer funding of abortion. And she is opposed by the National Rifle Association, which has endorsed me, rating me A-plus rating, and backing me in my reelection bid because I delivered the right to carry concealed weapons to Missourians 9 years ago last month when we overrode Bob Holden's veto, when he vetoed the right to carry concealed weapons. And I led the override attempt that put that on the law books that we've had it on now for 9 years.
Okay. Well, Lieutenant Governor, as the grassroots has been vetting their candidates, I know that you've been asked this question before, but I know that the grassroots and Missouri Grassroots Coalition have been looking at the Lieutenant Governor's race and looking how that office operates, and obviously there is some influence over the legislature in that office, so you have the power to break ties in the Senate, and there were some questions within the grassroots about some tie-breaking votes that you were involved in, and we'd like to give you an opportunity to clear some of those things up here on the air so that the people can have that information with them when they go to polls on Tuesday.
I answered these in a comprehensive fashion on Facebook.
Okay.
I posted on the Grassroots Coalition. I do not have that in front of me, but I would be happy to refer people to my extensive answer.
Sure.
To this very question on the Grassroots Coalition Facebook site. Now, let me answer you generally.
Missouri Grassroots Coalition, you put a thread on Missouri Grassroots Coalition? Is that right?
I did, yes.
Okay. All right. We'll go back
two and a half weeks ago.
Okay.
And I was praised by Carl Bearden and other, and by the guy who asked the question.
Okay.
For taking time out of a busy campaign to
Absolutely.
Respond.
Absolutely. And we do appreciate
now,
that because that's what people want to know.
Let me address this. There were six tie-breaking votes.
Yes.
There were six ties. Okay? None of them, Lisa, not one of them was on final passage of the bill. All they were on were amendments. The ties occurred, I believe, in every case on an amendment offered by Democrats. If I oppose the amendment and the vote has tied, the amendment fails on a tie vote. It does not need me to break that tie to fail.
Right.
The record of the Missouri Senate in the journal, of the Missouri Senate Journal, shows that I was present on those 5 days and chose not to vote because the tie defeated the amendment that I opposed. Is that clear?
Yes, I understand that. So if you
vote
no,
there
or
was
you
a
do not vote. Yes.
If I don't vote on a tie, the amendment fails.
Right.
In each case, I oppose the amendment, so voting against it would have defeated the amendment, but it was not necessary to defeat it because a tie vote defeated it.
Right.
Okay.
So,
the record shows that I was present on those days, as I was 97% plus presiding over the Missouri Senate this year. I missed two legislative days this year. One was when I had foot surgery in St. Louis, and the other was when I was doing official business, also in St. Louis, speaking at an Alzheimer's conference, and I could not preside that day.
Right.
Now there was a sixth vote in the fall of 2011. And I was not present in the Capitol. It was a late night session, Lisa. I had presided. I had been in and out of the Capitol that day, but had not presided that day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Senate was the reason I was not there when they were voting and when this tie occurred was that I had accepted months earlier an invitation to speak to in-home health care people. Part of my job as lieutenant governor is advocating for the elderly and impacting on senior issues.
Absolutely.
That impact Missouri seniors. That's a statutory obligation. I was meeting with them at a conference center at the Lake of the Ozarks. It was six to 7:30 in the evening. That's about the time this tie vote occurred. I was about an hour away from the Capitol down at a Lake of the Ozarks convention meeting place.
Was that tie vote related to the caucus and the primary? Was that the particular tie vote?
It may have been. I'd have to refer to my notes. It may have been. But the point is, I missed that one because I was on official business about an hour away from the Capitol.
Well, it's my understanding you have a 97% attendance rate on the vote.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. On presiding.
Presiding over and right, okay.
Which is the constitutional duty of the lieutenant governor.
So I think the question from the grassroots folks, I think the heart of the question was that what they were trying to find out was where you stood on the vote that brought us the primary. I think that's really what they want to know. If you cast a no vote, on that, or if because you were absent it cast a no vote and we had the primary,
I opposed a meaningless primary that cost us $7 million.
Right.
Okay.
And now you are on record as saying you opposed the primary.
Yes.
Okay. I think that was the question at the heart of that issue right there that the folks were trying to get to the matter of.
Okay.
So also, last week when you were on, you were talking a little bit about the UN election monitors. And we had some information a little while ago that they've arrested some election monitors in Iowa. Do you have any information about that here in Missouri?
You know what? In the ensuing, I tried to sound the alarm to our fellow Missourians and to my friends in legislative leadership that we need to keep these election monitors out of Missouri. But, Lisa, in the ensuing 10 days or 2 weeks since I was on your air discussing this, I've been so busy traveling across Missouri that I have not followed it, except I did hear the Attorney General of Texas, Greg Abbott, say on Fox News, I think it was 7 or 8 or 9 days ago, that they had a statute on the books in Texas and they were not going to permit these folks to come within 100 feet of a polling place and that he would pursue having them arrested. So you're telling me that some actually were arrested in Iowa?
Well, I think that the information coming in is that they will arrest, and they haven't quite yet done that. So
okay.
I think my information was a little false at the beginning, but the hammer will come down if there's a problem.
Lisa, I tried to get out in front on this issue by sounding the alarm to my fellow Missourians. By the way, for doing that, I came under attack by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial page.
And are we surprised by that?
No.
They
are all for the UN coming in and monitoring our elections. And my view is we've been having elections in Missouri for 200 years, and we've been having them in the United States for 236 years, and actually longer if you consider colonial period. And we don't need the UN folks from Albania coming in here and certifying our elections. And let me tell you, We have rumblings of violence from the left if they don't get their way next Tuesday with the reelection of President Obama. They are, Michael Moore has this ad out now in MoveOn.org,
mm-hmm.
where this woman, is a series of people on the ad are threatening violence.
I saw
if the election, that. If the election does not go their way. Now, what they want to do is set the table for saying that we had UN monitors in here, and the UN monitors found voter suppression of, let's say, Obama voters, wherever they might be found, and the voter turnout was lower, likely to be lower this year than it was in 08, for a host of reasons. Disillusionment with this president who has not followed through on his promises, the failure of his economic policies, the failure of his foreign policy, and the failure to help minority communities who are suffering some of the worst economic plight under this president. So their vote is going to be down, and these people want to allege that somehow conservatives suppressed that minority vote. And we've got to be ready for this, and I just say push back at every opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, and with the voter fraud that we're seeing come up and with the problems with the election, the electronic ballots, it's going to be an interesting ride the next couple of days.
Yes, these reports out of Ohio where somebody went in and voted for Romney and the machine had it come up Obama.
Yeah,
it's really scary.
In St. Louis, it's happened already, and I think in two or three other states they have reports of that as well. So it's happening here in Missouri, folks. So you need to be aware.
Yeah, and my whole battle against Obamacare, Lisa, was based on a desire to push back against the federal government, a firm belief that we need fighters in state government who will do that.
Right.
A firm belief that we need to reassert the 10th Amendment and the 9th Amendment that we've lost for about 80 years now. We need to recover the 10th Amendment, which says that those powers not expressly delegated to Congress are reserved to the states and to the people. The first words in our Constitution in the preamble are, "We the people." And, you know, Senator McCaskill gives the impression that we work for her, and it's the other way around. She works for us. And she is not the senator from Missouri. She's not Missourian's senator. She's Barack Obama's senator.
And that's been apparent ever since she rubber stamped the Obamacare, you know, against the wishes of 71% of Missourians.
And the spending and the debt.
Yeah.
The stimulus.
And stimulus and tax credits and everything else.
Yes.
Well, Lieutenant Governor, we wish you the best of luck the next few days on the campaign trail. We hope you'll check in with us again and let us know how things are going, and we hope to talk to you again on the other side.
I look forward to that. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thanks. Good luck to you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we will be back in a few minutes.
This is the Grassroots Minute. After weeks of the RNC publicly denouncing Missouri GOP Senate candidate Todd Akin and not a peep out of the Missouri GOP of support, the Missouri GOP has stuck its finger in the air and realized the breeze was going in the direction of the grassroots movement of the party that is supporting Akin with huge numbers. As we know, the establishment arm of the party controls who gets what and when and normally wouldn't give a hoot what we think. But with big names like Newt, DeMint, and Santorum throwing support to Akin, what else could Lloyd Smith and David Cole and their cronies do but save face and announce support for the grassroots choice? This is not only great news for Akin and his supporters in unseating McCaskill, but equally great news for the movement in changing the state party back to representing the true conservative arm and not the establishment rhinos. Now get out there and elect our choice for Senate, Todd Akin. This is Terry Varner for the Grassroots Minute.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you are listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour. We're wrapping things up before this is our last show before the election, and we're trying to get everything in as we can. We just heard from Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder giving us a campaign trail update, and I believe we have Cynthia Davis on the line, waiting to give us. We haven't had Cynthia on for quite a while, so she's going to give us her perspective from the Constitution Party campaign trail. Good evening, Cynthia.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you on. How are things going for you, Cynthia, on the campaign trail as a Constitution Party candidate?
It has been utterly fantastic. Let me just say, if I were running as a Republican, I wouldn't have these opportunities to be there on your ballot in November. So I'm thoroughly enjoying this. I was in Rolla over the weekend, and I've been everywhere, frankly. I don't know. My newspaper has been going all over Missouri. So there could be some of your listeners who've seen it, and it's on my website if you didn't get it in the mail. We had a very limited number that went to the most special people, but that doesn't mean it's too late to see it because it is on my website, which is votecynthia.com. And in there, I put some of the cities I've been to. And I will tell you this much, Lisa, I am running circles around my opponents. I mean, I'm going everywhere and doing everything. A week ago tonight, I was at a candidate forum in Jefferson City. I've been, you know what is interesting? I'm not seeing them at any of the candidate forums. And I'm like, this is very cool. I get the stage to myself. And where I'm going, I've had hundreds of people come out, and they love the message because they love liberty. They love freedom. They love the bedrock that made this a great country to begin with. And we are tapping in and connecting with the real people, and is a powerful and dynamic force.
Well, that's no surprise to me. And if there's anybody out there who doesn't know, Cynthia left the Republican Party not too long ago to run as a Constitution Party candidate. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, Cynthia, because you really felt that you could be more grounded to constitutional principles in the Constitution Party.
Well, and yeah, here's the point. It's like Martin Luther King Jr. said, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty I'm free at last. I don't have to make everybody happy in the Republican Party anymore. I can speak the truth. I can tell them what's going on. We're having a moment of honesty here in Missouri. And yes, I am an intervention, but it's a badly needed intervention that had to happen.
And you really do enjoy a great deal of support in the grassroots community. I know you've been all over the state, and you know, we at Missouri Grassroots Coalition network with folks all over the state, and Cynthia Davis is a popular candidate across Missouri.
And there has never been a better opportunity. You have to look at, connect the dots, and what you're going to observe is more people than ever are losing their satisfaction with both major parties. They're saying, you know what, I tried it, and it wasn't good for me. It didn't work out. I'm fed up. Let me go vote for the candidate who best resonates with my values, because what they're putting up there in front of us isn't worth eating anymore.
Absolutely. So, Cynthia, we know the lieutenant governor's, it's a different position than most other elected offices. You preside over the Senate. But your vision for this office is what exactly? What do you, as a lieutenant governor from the Constitution Party, what do you hope to do for the state?
Number one, accountability. That's what's so sorely lacking right now. You know, a Republican is going to try and make the Republicans all look good. A Democrat's going to try and make the Democrats look good. Nobody is raising the iron shade and letting the sun shine into all those backroom deals in the cigar smoke-filled poker tables, which I've seen and been around plenty of times. That's where the decisions are made, and they're leaving us out. Now, Lisa, let me ask you, how frustrated do you feel when you get another panic email from some grassroots group saying, call your elected representative and tell them, don't do it, don't do it, they're going to hurt us again. I'm like, you know what, I get so fatigued.
It's a lot of work.
Oh, my goodness, why are we electing them if we have to babysit them all the time?
Absolutely, and that's just that's probably the best example or best description. It's the truth. I mean, if you don't have one eye on them constantly, you know, they're doing all kinds of crazy stuff. They're not necessarily there fighting for the Constitution and fighting for the people that they represent. They're kind of making deals.
So I've got a plan.
All right.
And it is very frustrating. I know when you get, you read, you know, they're doing bad things again. Because I spent, remember, 8 years in the legislature knocking my head against the wall saying, what? You know, we grew government bigger. We made government more intrusive. We made it more expensive. The budget went from $18 billion to $24 billion. I mean, what gives? I mean, and that was with Republicans in control. When I got elected in 2002, that we were going to clean house. We were going to right all the wrongs that had been perpetrated on us by 48 years of Democrat rule. You know what? The fervor went out pretty early in the process. And pretty soon complacency set in. And we said, you know what, hey, might as well live and let live. And now we're going to, you know, there are all these lobbyists who want all these special things and the special interest groups want things and everybody wanted to be a nice guy. Well, you know what, we were nice to everybody except the taxpayers.
Right.
There's a point where you have to say that's too much. So the last year I was there, by the last year, I ended up voting against every budget bill except the one to pay our debts because it seemed like they had lost all sensitivity to right and wrong, to what is the difference between more than and less than. A very simple math concept. My, you know, elementary school kids can get that. Is it more than or less than? And I'm frustrated, obviously, because I had to be a part of the group. So every Thursday before they sent the legislators home, they had caucus and they'd put into our hands the talking points and tell us to go home and talk about this weekend. And you know what? There was a part of me that said, yeah, but what if I don't want to talk about this? And there were times when it was not my topic, and I didn't want it. It didn't fit. It just, you know, it didn't fit with freedom. Maybe it, you know, sometimes you couldn't make out, is this a, what caucus am I in? Was this the Republican one or the Democrat one? Because they're pushing bigger government. I don't even recognize this. So let me just say one thing. I am more Republican than the rest of the Republicans in the sense that my principles have not changed one iota. I believe in limited government, personal responsibility, and fiscal responsibility. And that is all the same that it's always been. But when the party shifts to the left and you find yourself very lonely because I'm not surrounded by people who share my values, I could probably count on one hand the other people who were strong and brave and would do the right thing regardless of who's funding it and regardless of what kind of pressure they're getting. And that's okay because, you know, we were strong and brave, the few of us, and that's how I won the award for being the most constitutional legislator in the state of Missouri.
Absolutely. And it, and there is no, it's no secret that the folks over the whole revolutionary rise of the Tea Party comes from people really looking for leadership and elected to move to the right, to be constitutionally grounded, to be and to be conservative. And, you know, the two-party system is not working anymore. The two-party systems are pretty much there to perpetuate themselves, and people need to start really giving some serious consideration to the third-party candidates. And Cynthia Davis is that person.
Well, you know, I mean, I've never been through a divorce, but I have to say it did kind of feel like it when I walked away from the Republican Party, because there was a lot of hostility and animosity and people acting like, you know, I mean, all the feelings people go through during a divorce of feeling this rejection and why couldn't we make it work and maybe we needed counseling, all those questions came up, because you've got to realize, a year ago, I mean, up until a year ago, I was the head of the Republican Party in St. Charles County. So I'm not just a casual Republican. I was deeply engaged. I was in the leadership of the Republican Party.
Right.
And after giving my blood, sweat, and tears to grow the party, I found out it's not working. You know what?
Mm-hmm.
I tried. I gave it my best. And anybody who's probably been through a divorce knows there's a point when you have to say, it's not there. It's not going to work. It's gone. Whatever whatever we tried, it's beating a dead horse. And I know there are a lot of good people who are trying to reform the party from within, and God bless all of you for trying. I did it. I've been there. I've done it probably more than most of our listeners. And I all I can say is that we're still watching the party shift to the left every year. Yeah. They've got more legislators than ever before who are Republican. And with the big boom of the greatest number of Republicans, what have they done? Well, the House passed health care exchanges for Obamacare. Now, it didn't make it to the governor's desk, but they thought that was a good idea. They passed the prescription drug monitoring program, meaning Big Brother knows what kind of drugs you're taking. They passed the Facebook prohibition law. What is this? What country is this? It's not recognizable anymore.
And the best thing, America is founded and thrives on competition. So one of the best ways maybe to turn things around in this country is to introduce a little bit more competition into the party system. Cynthia Davis is running for lieutenant governor in the Constitution Party. Cynthia, if people want to get involved in your campaign and help you out the last few days, how do they find you?
Go to VoteCynthia.com, and I desperately need help financially because we're making an amazing statement on a grassroots budget, and yet it's going well, but you better believe every $5 and $10 are making a huge difference right now. We're doing shock and awe. People are getting excited. It's never happened like this before in Missouri. We are mobilizing the troops, but it still takes money to communicate. I do have the greatest volunteers ever in the entire world, I'll tell you that much. People who've worked tirelessly to make a difference. People who understand what's at stake and who want to help and pitch in and save what we've got. Because I'll tell you right now, if I win this race, it will cause ripples not only through the entire state, but the entire nation.
Absolutely.
People are, they want to see. Can brave people, have we kept the door open long enough that good people can still get elected, or are all those seats really sewn up by the big money? I don't know.
Right.
We're doing a grand experiment to find out.
Yeah, put Cynthia Davis in office and VoteCynthia.com is the website, right?
That's it. And politics has become a dirty business, but we can clean it up if we get some principled people there.
Very good. Thank you, Cynthia. We wish you the best of luck for the next few days on the campaign trail, and we hope to talk to you on the other side of Tuesday.
I will. I'll be the designated driver in the room full of drunks.
There you go, girl. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. We'll be right back with Ray Cuneo and his information on Agenda 21. Here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, it's Christmas in July and August and September. Last year on Christmas Eve, MGC paid off the department store layaway accounts of two Missouri families who were not able to provide Christmas for their children. This year, we would like to at least double that number, and in an attempt to do that by the holiday season, we're asking you to consider donating a few dollars toward that effort. We know the holiday season is the most difficult time of year to ask for donations, so we're planning ahead and asking you to give whatever you can so that a few Missouri families will be able to celebrate at Christmas. Go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and look for the Secret Santa page. All the details are there for you to donate by PayPal, check, or money order. Conservatives have proven to be the most generous and most benevolent people in the United States. Please help us with this very small charitable project.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
We're back. We're in the last run of Wednesday evening's Halloween show for Culture Vigilante. We have one more segment tonight. Ray Cuneo is with us again on another installment of our education on Agenda 21. Ray talks to us tonight about the Wildlands Project, and it's just remarkable all the information that Ray's imparted to us and the craziness of this whole Agenda 21 issue. It's something that people just don't understand. So let's take a listen to that interview now.
Good evening. We're here with Ray Cuneo again. He's giving us updates on the Agenda 21 issue and how it affects you. This week, we're going to be talking about the Wildlands Project and what that means to you as an individual citizen in your area. Thanks for being with us, Ray.
Well, thank you for having me, and good evening to you.
Okay, Ray, we've talked about several of these issues. We've touched on these things. We've broken them down into pieces just to make them a little bit easier to digest. This Wildlands Project is a real big deal. So what is this all about?
Well, let me begin by saying that, previously in some of our other segments, we had mentioned that two of Agenda 21's goals was biodiversity restoration and preservation. That's a significant goal, as well as population control and reduction. Control of land and resource by government is a central theme, really, of Agenda 21 Sustainable Development. Agenda 21 Sustainable Development advocates two methods of land and resource and population use. The first one we have already discussed, that is the urban areas that require implementation of what they call smart growth policies, which essentially, as we've discussed, is stop growth, push people into high density housing, control where they work, their mobility, etc. The thing we're going to discuss today is, okay, what about the rest of America, the rural areas of America, which from a land area standpoint comprises the vast majority of the United States. The Wildlands Project is also known as, in the environmental and government agency circles, as ecosystem management. Some of your listeners may have heard these terms: ecosystem management, ecoregion, biosphere reserves, heritage areas, etc. But all of them are focused on the same goal and outcome, and that is, in essence, the Wildlands Project. Well, what does the Wildlands Project seek to do? The Wildlands Project advocates, as I said before, restoration, preservation of biodiversity, which they refer to as, we would commonly refer to as the environment. And they want to do that by depopulating vast areas of America. And the goal, eventually, over a long period of time, is to depopulate 50% of the United States to where it's rewilded. That's where they come up with the term rewilding or Wildlands Project. 50% of the United States, the lower 48 states anyway, which has roughly 2 billion acres, that's B, 2 billion acres in the lower 48, and they would like to make 50% of that, or a billion acres, eventually off limits to human activity and rewild it back to nature before man was here.
So, Ray, isn't it true that the federal government has been gobbling up land for quite some time? They are in ownership of most of the national parks across the country. Is that part of this?
Well, yes. It is part of it, and yes, you are correct. When it comes to ownership, the federal and our state government owns, in the case of the national parks, the federal government owns that. In the case of state parks, the states own that. And, of course, any off-limit already designated wilderness areas is owned by the federal government, which is currently about 100 million acres. So when you roll all of the state and national parks and this 100 million acres of designated wildlands already, that constitutes about a little over 12% of the total land area of the United States. Now, actually, the federal government controls more than that. They actually control about 45% between the state and federal governments. They control 45%, not that they have full ownership, but control roughly 45% of the 2 billion acres in the lower 48 already. So there's a significant area already under control by the federal government. And I don't want to get too much
into this issue of who owns what, but, for example, the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management already, they have significant land holdings, which is also also private landowners have vested interest in those lands through water rights. It gets a little bit complicated, and that's something we can address in a later session. But the point being is, yes, the federal government controls significant areas already. But, you know, I mentioned 100 million acres. Now, that has already been designated as wild lands where nobody is supposed to go. And I think, I can't remember what celebrity it was here a few years ago that was out snowmobiling in the Rockies someplace, got in a wilderness area and got fined for being there, et cetera, et cetera. So these areas that are already designated as wilderness is off limits to human beings being there. Now, obviously, most of this land that is government-owned and controlled is in the western United States. However, let's just take the state of Missouri. The state of Missouri, there is roughly about 8%, 8 to 9% of the land area of the state of Missouri is controlled by either the federal or state government in as national forest or state parks. So the idea of the Wildlands Project, though, is to greatly expand these areas to where you eventually, over a period of decades or a period of several generations, that the government gains full control and access of as much as 100 billion acres, which is roughly 50% of the lower 48 United States. And, of course, there's a whole variety of ways that they have been using over the past 20 years, and they will continue to use and expand and be more aggressive with. For example, back in the 90s, they were the environmental groups and a lot of the federal agencies were pushing for breaching of a lot of the major dam systems in the United States. They even advocated, for example, breaching the Glen Canyon Dam, which is at the head of the Grand Canyon, the Grand Coulee Dam up in eastern Washington, and it goes on and on. They also are continuing to push road closures, hiking trails, but predominantly road closures going through any of these national forests or federal lands. Now, they're doing it slow, methodically. They're pushing continually to stop logging, to stop hiking trails, to any kind of RV trails, hunting trails, and eventually even highway systems going through these.
So what's the point of all of this, Ray? I mean, is this really just to keep people in a contained area so they can control the people? Why would they want to shut off all of these resources to the people?
Because they want to essentially cage people into islands of humanity, which is going to be the urban areas that we discussed in, implemented through the smart growth system, and then turn over the rest of the United States in these wild lands, which will be truly for all the wild critters out there. They want the buffaloes to roam the high plains from Canada to Mexico, as they did 200 years ago. They want major carnivores to be able to migrate from across the United States, north to south, or east to west. And, of course, how they're going to do that, they'll create these islands. They'll have a national park, which will be the core area, and that will start out as being off limits to people, and it will continually, they'll grow and expand this to what they call buffer areas and eventually eliminate people having access to that. The goal is to rewild, just as it says, rewild back to nature and get man out of those areas, because the environmental groups, the major environmental groups, which are really running our federal agencies now, and the UN agencies, by the way, and this is a worldwide goal, and of course the United States is forefront of this. And they want people out of there. They want people into what they call sustainable communities, where you're going to have your own little garden, I guess, that's going to sustain you. And as I started to say, how they want to acquire this 100 million acres, or 100 billion acres, is really a couple of the tools that they're effectively using is the Endangered Species Act, which they have really been abusing, also the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. Now, none of us are against taking care of species. None of us are against clean water, clean air. But what when those laws were written and enacted in the early 70s, they had a specific legislative intent. Well, as happened so much of the time, these federal agencies get them, they rewrite the legislative intent in a regulatory form to totally distort and expand to their own agenda. And, of course, they're using, like, the Endangered Species Act, going back into the 90s, the Spotted Owl. The Spotted Owl, which even the Sierra Club now has, after 20 years later, has admitted it was a sham. It was a facade. But that destroyed the timber industry in major sections of the United States, also the mining industry. And they're continuing to use the Endangered Species Act very effectively today to drive people off of privately owned property and to shut down and close people out of certain areas of the national forest and federal lands.
And it's not really so much that they want to champion nature. It's really about corralling the people into sustainable development areas so that they can control the population.
It's both. They truly believe that the world we're going to destroy the world. We the people. We're a curse to the earth. And the advocacy is that we need to give nature back to nature, and that people need to be corralled and caged and into these urban areas. And of course, agriculture across the United States, as we've mentioned before, one of the major tools there in Agenda 21, or one of the goals, is to eliminate modern agriculture. Well, back in the early 90s, back when in the cattle industry is big throughout the West, and it runs on a lot of federal grounds and National Forest Service, and the environmentalists had a slogan even back in the early 90s, and it applied to all of the United States because they're totally against animal agriculture any place in the world, but certainly in the United States. The slogan was cattle free by 93. And the major environmental groups are and these federal agencies, EPA, Corps of Engineers, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Department of Interior, they're all working hand in glove with these major environmental groups to push people and push agriculture and push use of our resources and land, not only out of the federal lands, but many times out of adjoining private property that is within the federal land system or adjoining the federal land system. And they have very effective tools to do that. I mentioned the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act, if you find a little critter on your place that's endangered, they can absolutely stop all activity, all human activity on your ground. Regardless of, you can have full fee simple title to your property and they can stop it. To make matters worse, on the Endangered Species Act in 1995, there was a Supreme Court ruling known as Babbitt versus Sweet Home, Oregon. Bruce Babbitt was the Secretary of Interior at the time. But that Supreme Court case ruled that not only was a little critter protected from harm under the Endangered Species Act, but also any habitat. Now, which means that if you had an endangered species on a federal piece of ground and you had your private property next to it and it had the same type of habitat yours did as the little critter on the federal lands, you could not do anything with your property. So what the net effect of it was to really make willing sellers adjoining a lot of these federal lands. And believe me, and I know a lot of people probably in Missouri and across the eastern part of the country in particular haven't heard a lot about this, but the western United States, and really all of the United States, but predominantly in the west, has been under assault for years. And the federal government, that is their main goal. And the goal of this Wildlands Project, if you can envision having core natural wilderness areas scattered all across the United States. Let's just take, for example, Missouri, the Mark Twain National Forest. And that is a core area where nobody could go under this scenario. And then those areas, Mark Twain may be connected to the Ozark region in northern Arkansas by a corridor system of rivers and streams, which along those rivers and streams you would be no use of private property. This would enable the wildlife to transit from wildlands core segment, for example, the Mark Twain National Forest, to the Ozark Forest in northern Arkansas. It might be the elk that they've reintroduced down there. It might be the black bears or any other species that they choose to reintroduce.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about the elk project that they just reintroduced in Missouri either late last year or this year. Ridiculous. Is that part of this situation? It's a ridiculous situation. They're reintroducing elk to Missouri.
Right.
Crazy. Absolutely nuts.
It absolutely is part of this because, and I don't know if we'll have time to discuss it today, but we need to discuss this further, what happened specifically here in Missouri regarding the Wildlands Project back in 1995, 96, and 97. I was deeply involved in that. It was called Ozark Man and the Biosphere. But to answer your question about the elk, yes, absolutely. Elk reintroduction. In fact, the way the wording went in the Ozark Man and the Biosphere, which was a UN biosphere designated area for southern Missouri, the part of the wording in there in regards to species introduction was to reintroduce extirpated species. Extirpated meaning that those species, according to the government agencies involved, was once natural to Missouri. So Missouri Department of Conservation claims that elk were natural to this area. I have not been able to document that by any other source. Not that it's not true, but I haven't been able to find it other than from Missouri Department of Conservation sources. But be that as it may, it makes no sense. Even if they were once part of Missouri landscape, when we have roughly, I believe, roughly 5.5 or 6 million people in the state of Missouri of, 57,000 square miles, elk require a large, to be viable and thrive, they require a large landscape where they can migrate from one area to the other, like in the western mountain regions. And we do not have that landscape here, but we're far too densely populated.
Right.
And, of course, they've reintroduced the black bears. They deny that they have any hand in all of the mountain lions that are showing up here. But it is amazing how many have been run across or found now in Missouri.
Oh, absolutely.
Go ahead.
There are mountain lion sightings I live in St. Charles County, and people are sighting them. So, and it's insanity. And if people think that they've got a problem with deer in their areas and in these populated areas, wait till the elk start showing up in your backyard.
Well, and just look. Now, here's another example of the Endangered Species Act. Think of the geese population. Back the Canadian geese here were, and they're on the endangered species list. Why, I don't know. But you cannot. If there's a goose crossing down there in St. Charles or in St. Louis, you better not hit one of those. You better not get out in any way harm those because they are federally endangered. They have a right-of-way there before humans do. And that is the goal of this whole thing. The river systems all tie together here. And for example, here in the mid-90s, just to show you how aggressive these federal and environmental groups are and federal agencies, U.S. Fish and Wildlife on the Missouri River wanted to expand their national wildlife. Wildlife Refuge, which was about 16,000 acres, to whatever number they could get to. And they went into a two-year study and public input forum. And anyway, long story short, after the end of 2 years, they came out with a final report, which is about 3 inches thick. And they had listed five possible goals in there. And they chose one which was about to double the size of their holdings. I don't know, went to 25 or 30,000 acres. But what is so significant, and this is really significant, this is the Missouri River floodplain. They advocated one of the goals, long-term, was acquisition, this exact wording, acquisition by any means of all the Missouri River floodplains, bluff to bluff, from Kansas City to St. Louis.
Oh my gosh.
The long-term goal for the Missouri River floodplain is acquisition by federal government. Now, a lot of people say, well, why would they want it? Because they want the... They want the Missouri River floodplain, the Mississippi River floodplain, the Merrimack River floodplain, the Burbage River floodplain, any floodplain that drains a watershed to be corridors for wildlife to move from one area to the other, be it black bear, be it mountain lions, be it elk, be it whatever it is.
No, okay, we're going to have to pick this up again next week, Ray, and expand upon this wildlands project, because it's a huge, huge, huge deal and a huge part of this Agenda 21 scenario.
It's very real. It is happening.
And good luck with the floodplain expansion. We've got cities built along floodplains all over the country, especially in Missouri. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Thank you, Ray, for being with us. We will talk to you again next week and pick up on the Wildlands Project and some of the details about how they're going about accomplishing this.
Real good. Thank you.
Thanks, Ray.
Okay, folks, we're wrapping it up here for another week of Culture Vigilante. All of the trick-or-treaters have gone home. We've scared all the liberal out of them, and they're all nice, good little conservative children now, and they have too much candy, so they probably won't sleep well tonight with all of the nightmares of the ghosts and the ghouls and too much sugar. So can't reiterate enough, if you haven't gotten behind a candidate, any last-minute things that you can do to help your candidates along between now and Tuesday will be appreciated. This election hangs in the balance with this election, as far as I'm concerned. This 2012 election is about freedom and liberty, and how you vote will make a difference on the rest of your life and your children's lives and their children's lives. So make sure that you get out and vote on Tuesday. Please come out and see us on Saturday afternoon at 12:30 at Wentzville Parkway with our Save Our Sheriff's Department sign wave. Go to the Missouri Grassroots Coalition webpage and look at our voter guide and all of the voter guides that we have listed there so that you can become informed when you go to the ballot on Tuesday. Vote no on Prop A. And go to 24thstate.com, and read up on Prop A. Thursday night, tomorrow night, you'll have Kevin Harned, Hillbilly Logic. Friday night, we have the Missouri Grassroots Roundtable. And Monday night, the night before the election, you'll have Dave Court, Mr. Hour of Truth, giving us the last-minute punctuation on the importance of all the issues, all the campaign, candidates for Tuesday morning. And on Tuesday night, we'll be reporting in live from various watch parties around the state and giving you your election results. And that wraps it up for another week of Culture Vigilante here on Missouri Grassroots Coalition. We will talk to you after the election. It'll all be over by this time next week. So go out and vote and exercise your freedom. Good night.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.